Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we are joined by Michael Knox Berin, who's on the phone with us from New York. Good evening, sir.
Good evening, Milt.
It's great to have you here again. I've been reading some of your recent pieces in City Journal and in National Review, and as usual, I'm quite impressed by your insights, and they teach me something. They teach me a good deal, in fact. I want to focus on three particular recent articles of yours tonight, if I may. One is titled Exposing the Elites, another is titled The Descent of Liberalism, and a third, in a different direction, is titled The Dark Night of Islam. Going first to your work on the elites, and I might note instantly that among your books, the most recent, published I believe last year, is titled Pathology of the Elites.
That's right.
And you start your article in City Journal just March 24, you started with this paragraph. In 1997, George Soros, writing in The Atlantic, declared, "The main enemy of the open society, I believe, is no longer the communist, but the capitalist threat," which is a strange view to be enunciated by a man who's made some $15 billion out of his participation one way or another in the capitalist system, or at least in the currency side of the capitalist system. Even more astounding is that Warren Buffett, whom I also mentioned earlier, does contribute a good deal to leftist political causes, not as much as Soros does, even though he's got more money. He's got some $40 billion. In general, it is remarkable that we find lots of people, Wall Street people, and certainly the Hollywood elite, and others with big bucks, pouring those big bucks in the leftwards direction. What sense are we to make of that?
Well, it's not altogether anomalous. If you look at history, this has been a tactic which a governing class or a ruling elite uses to perpetuate its power once it's got it, to prevent other people from rising up and taking them out, as it were. You see this in Disraeli's revival of the Tory party in England in the 1800s. Disraeli says that poses the party as the champions of the working class people and of social reform, and effectively the aristocrats pose as champions of the poor. This was used to great effect by Bismarck in creating the foundation for the social welfare state in Germany, and it was used to an extent by the Roosevelts in this country, who were merchant patricians champion the working man, but in doing so, preserve their own power as a ruling elite.
Well, how does championing the working man and providing that sort of blanket or that undergirding of the working class so that they can't fall to absolute destruction, but will be somehow guaranteed wages and medical care and so on. How does that possibly advance and maintain the fortunes of the super plutocrats?
Well, yes, they can't fall, but at the same time, the machinery that is put into place to maintain these social welfare systems requires a vast amount of intervention, control, and regulation by the state. Higher rates of taxation, a greater portion of the gross domestic wealth of the product of the country comes under the control of the state and the people who run the state. And this slowly but very definitely stagnates the freedom where you get the kind of entrepreneurial development and growth that that bring new people forward and let them rise up. I mean, this is always Lincoln's theory of the United States. You start working for somebody else, and then you are able to hire somebody a little later on and become sort of a capitalist on your own and acquire your own fortune, your own wealth. The social imagination that the reform that the patricians have put in, the elites, is much different. It doesn't allow for that, or it puts a brake on that kind of entrepreneurial growth.
Well, is it done with that much cynicism? Let's somehow protect the workers. Let's protect the ordinary people, so they, by overloading them with regulations and so on, but by also guaranteeing them more or less security from cradle to grave, as Lord Beaverbrook said many years ago. Let's do all of that to preserve our own hold on vast wealth. Or is there also a desire to, on their part and on the part of many others, of lesser wealth, but also of equal social concern. Isn't there also a kind of an altruistic impulse?
Yeah, I think in many of them is. Now, in a case like Bismarck, you have very clearly a much more cynical attitude.
Uh-huh.
He was not altruistic in his philosophy. But I think what you see in the elites in England and America is very much this sense that they are doing good. And I think this is what the sort of most dangerous thing about the social reform policies that some of our elites have adopted is that it is what Lionel Trilling calls a mask of the will, which masks itself in benevolence.
Your
the
reference
idea that you're doing good, that by sort of ruling people, you're helping them. You're doing good. This Trilling, in his essay in The Liberal Imagination on Henry James, I think puts it very clearly when he talks about one of James's characters in one of his novels, an American-born woman who marries into European nobility and becomes a social reformer.
That's the Princess Casamassima, I believe.
Yes, Princess Casamassima. Trilling says that she is the very embodiment of the modern will, which masks itself in virtue, making itself appear harmless. The will that hates itself finds its manifestations and desire for power guilty and is able to exist only if it operates in the name of virtue. And Trilling goes on to say, the lesson he derives is that some paradox of our nature leads us, when once we have made our fellow men the objects of our enlightened interest, to go on to make them objects of our pity, then of our wisdom, ultimately of our coercion.
Now, as you look around our world, our time, our place, as you look around these United States right now, do you see that in operation, and if so, where?
Well, I think an example that will come to many people's minds would be the health care law.
How so?
Here you have something that is ostensibly benevolent, which is going to bring more people, give more people access to health insurance. At the same time, it's run on a system of price controls, and I've never seen the case where price controls has brought about a flourishing of the commodity being controlled. I mean, as Milton Friedman said in sort of Economics 101, the way to produce a shortage of everything is to announce that there's a price cap and that sellers can't sell any higher than that. If you do that in the grocery store, the shelves will be empty pretty quickly. The same thing applies to health care. This is a clear case of something that sounds good, and it's hard for people who generous instincts to be against it because it sounds cruel and hard-hearted. But in fact, the best thing you could do about health care would probably be, as Lord Melbourne liked to say, if you only just leave it alone.
Milton Friedman also at some point said, you can have freedom or you can have equality, but you can't have both. It's freedom or equality. Does that bear on what we're discussing right now?
Well, equality in terms of income, meaning
material equality.
I mean, equality under the law we have, and I think that's a virtue. We don't have different.
But the kind of equality which one has in mind when one goes for serious redistributionism.
Right. I think that's exactly right. Churchill put it well when he said, you know, the free market system or capitalism is an unequal sharing of blessings. The social approach is an equal sharing of miseries.
Well, we've been drawing from the one recent article exposing the elites. A related article is titled The Descent of Liberalism. You track there the changes through which liberalism has gone in our time, or really over the last 100 years or so. And indeed, the word has meant different things at different times. We're about to serve capitalism, which we do every 15 minutes. And then let's come directly back and draw from and look at the argument developed in this longer essay, which I found quite illuminating to me, titled The Descent of Liberalism, from the National Review in April of this year. No, April of last year, I guess. It's older,
right,
but it holds up, I would say. A year and a half have not, or a year and a quarter has not dimmed its relevance. We'll be directly back to Michael Knox Barron after these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we return to conversation with Michael Knox Barron. That's B-E-R-A-N, a distinguished writer. The Pathology of the Elites is his most recent book. Other books, Forge of Empires, 1861 to 1871, Jefferson's Demons, and The Last Patrician. As well, Michael is very busy doing significant writing in many of the serious journals available for those who do serious writing and serious thinking about who we are and how we manage our affairs. You will remember, I'm sure, a quotation from Churchill when about 50 years ago. Actually, I think the quotation can be traced earlier, but he used it certainly. And he said about 50 years ago, any man of 20 who's not a liberal doesn't have a heart. Any man of 50 who's not a conservative doesn't have a brain. Many would, of course, disagree with that. Surely most members of the Obama cabinet would disagree, as would, I am sure, the man that they report to. All the same, what did Churchill mean? What did 50 years ago liberal and conservative mean?
Well, I think by Churchill's time, liberalism was already evolving into what I would call the social liberalism we have today, which is very different from the what is often called the classical liberalism, which emerges at the end of the 18th century.
Classical liberalism goes back to essentially Adam Smith, doesn't it?
Yeah, to Adam Smith, to the Whig Revolution in England in the 17th century, and the freer markets in both intellectual, spiritual, religious, and economic matters that opened up after that. And it was one of the inspirations in the founding of our republic. And you look at the people that were then considered radicals, Jefferson, for example. In many ways, what he was a classical liberal. He believed in free trade and as much freedom for the individual as was compatible with the tranquility of the state. Now, we can put aside the glaring hypocrisy of slavery, but if you, with that caveat, you're looking at a man who is in many ways a classical liberal. And that continued to define liberalism in the United States for much of the 19th century. In the 19th century, you have huge intellectual revolution taking place with the advent of social philosophy. If the classical liberal view says you treat people equally under the law, whoever they are, the social philosophy, which emerges really with Hegel, Kant, Marx, and these philosophers, says that you can treat different social groups of people differently based on their needs, that you can find out the social laws that govern human life, much as there are certain laws that govern physics in the natural world, that you can use these experts trained in them, can use these laws to find out the best way to adjust the interests of different social groups. So you might treat people that make a certain amount of money differently under the law than people making less money. The state will, by managing these interests, produce a harmonious whole much superior to the invisible hand of Adam Smith. So this group social philosophy slowly but surely makes inroads in American liberalism.
And that leads to a different kind of liberalism. The same word now representing a different sort of social program, does it?
Yes, and you even in the rhetoric, I think, is different. You still see Franklin Roosevelt talking about the dangers of a dole, that it's a kind of narcotic that detaches effort and exertion. Yeah.
But on the same hand, he sees, to quote him, one-third of a country ill-housed, ill-clothed, and ill-fed.
At the same time, he is starting laying the foundations for an American welfare state with the aid for families with dependent children legislation and Social Security as something run by the government with the individual not really playing a big part in it. You see the same conflict in Kennedy, who famously espoused tax cuts, but at the same time, reading Michael Harrington's work, became committed to, or initially dreamed of, starting the war on poverty, which Lyndon Johnson, of course, carried on, which vastly expanded the social.
And you say reading Michael Harrington. Michael Harrington, of course, was a socialist and indeed the founder of the modern American socialist They're no longer a party. I forget what they call themselves, but they're still there.
Yes, yeah. Kennedy read the review in the New Yorker not long before he died in 1963, uh-huh. and jotted down some quick notes or said to somebody, you know, let's do something about this.
And, of course, in Lyndon Johnson, we have, in a way, the full victory of that point of view in the personification of the so-called war on poverty and all of the social legislation that followed thereupon.
Right. Yes, exactly. And that now has become the sort of, I think, the center and the core of American liberalism today. And, of course, from Harrington, you can trace the social activist thought that lies behind that philosophy. The thinkers that and activists who descend in his, you know, from him are very conscious about constantly extending the entitlement machinery of the federal government and the state government, and also creating, extending, and enlarging the public sector bureaucracies that administer these programs.
And with all of that, with administration comes supervision and comes intrusion and supervision.
Yeah. It's very different from the old classical vision. It's almost its antithesis. And we do feel the result in a more intrusive state. Now we're going to be required, whether we want to or not, to purchase health insurance. In dozens of small little ways, you find a more intrusive state, which really means less liberty of action for the individual.
Yet you report, again, in the very first paragraph of the article that I have, I'm referring to now, The Descent of Liberalism. Indeed, I can read a sentence from it. Over the next 60 years, however, the liberal imagination lost its hold on the American mind. And then, in October 2009, Gallup found that just 20% of Americans described themselves as liberals. Twice as many called themselves conservatives. Now, what are we to make of that, particularly in the light of the way in which we went on in 2008 to elect a president who clearly classifies as a liberal?
Well, in 2008, though, when he was a candidate, the president was denying that he was posing as a pragmatic centralist, which anybody that had read his books or followed some of the people that were writing about him closely and honestly knew was really not the case at all. But so I don't think that the election in 2008 was a referendum on liberalism. It was partly a natural reaction against 8 years of Republican rule. It was partly a reaction to the financial crisis of that autumn. So I don't read 208 as a mm-hmm. as a referendum supporting liberalism. And indeed, as soon as President Obama sort of showed himself as not a centralist, his poll numbers went down, and you know the health care law was one of the most unpopular pieces of legislation in memory. Indeed, it's extremely unusual to see a president and a Congress pass that kind of legislation, major epical social legislation, in the face of such intense public opposition. Very different from, I mean, Johnson was, you know, and Roosevelt could carry Republicans with them and carry the popular support of the people in putting their social legislation through. That was not the case with health care.
Yes, well, in fact, as it goes through Congress, it has certainly in the House not a single Republican vote, as I remember it.
Right.
As we now look forward to the next presidential election, and the presidential follies have already been launched, even this very day, they're making news about who is announcing and who is announcing that he will not run. Already, the polls are grinding away, asking what the fortunes of Obama will be once again, as compared to various other potential Republican candidates. And it doesn't look too bad for him at the moment.
Right. It's his to lose, but that's one of the virtues of incumbency. And but again, I don't think the election in 12 will be a referendum on the kind of social reform liberalism. I don't think right now that is popular in the country. The president may be adroit enough, however, to seem centralist enough to appease the voters.
I see.
Or that segment of the voters who But that, you know, it could change as the country changes. And one thing that we've seen in countries where the social welfare state becomes entrenched is it does, it becomes more popular as people become more dependent on it. And it, after a certain point,
until it reaches
it's very
the point
difficult to repeal or restrain.
Well, I mean, until it reaches the point of bankruptcy.
But even then, you look at the countries in Europe that are trying to take reasonable measures, Cameron in the U.K.
And they riot, riot in the streets, of course.
Yeah,
yes.
People, yeah. This is their, they have a right to it. As we believe we have right to life, liberty, and our own property, you have a right to these benefits from the state.
And under those circumstances, perhaps a new power arises that doesn't have that problem. It may be a power far to the east of, rather far to the west of where we are and in the eastern world. It may well be that that's, among other things, what will propel China to its elevation as ultimately, perhaps, for a century or so, the most powerful country in the world. But more of that anon. We are late for an update on the news. And for that, we go to the WGN newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Milt Rosenberg and Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
And directly back to Michael Knox Barron. You know, Michael, I was thinking maybe it's a matter of where the empowered politicians went to law school. Because most of them do go to law school. Now, you yourself, though you're not an empowered politician, you're an observer of that class. You yourself are a graduate of the Yale Law School. In my youth, I was an assistant professor at Yale. Yale is a source of comparative sensible conservatism, whereas Harvard Law School pushes them in another direction. President Obama is a Harvard man. But then I bethought me and remembered that Bill Clinton is is a graduate of Yale Law School.
The law schools, Harvard and Yale, they're really institutions for the left, I think. There are a few renegade conservatives on the right, but not many.
Well, why, in fact, are they? Why is it, in fact, the case that at the upper levels of the sort of the intellectual cadre or the professional dash intellectual cadre in this country, that much of the push is in the leftwards, quote, liberal direction?
I would say there that you do have a case of what Trilling is talking about, of the will to power, which masks itself as virtuous benevolence. The plans that come out of some of the constitutional thinking at the law schools, Bruce Ackerman, who's my professor and a very, very nice man, but who's essentially has a socialist policy where experts like Bruce Ackerman would run the new administrative social state and decide what's best for everybody, rather than leaving it to the capricious market to decide who gets what. It's this dream of a perfect fairness to be superintended by perfectly disinterested administrators, philosopher kings. Of course, we know how this has always worked, that in practice, any group of philosopher kings are human, and they become corrupted by the very power which they've hoped to exercise benevolently.
But also, you would argue, organizing a welfare state of the sort that they have done in Western Europe generally, ultimately is ruinous just in terms of its economic infeasibility.
I think so. And it's not just, however, philosophers that are on the right that have said this. I think one of the things that hasn't been noticed is the critique put forward by some of the New York intellectuals, such as Lionel Trilling, who never considered himself a conservative, by Hannah Arendt, who said something very interesting about what the social policies might lead to. And she said, and if somebody on the right said this, they'd be thought of as extreme, but she said that those kinds of social policies might yet reduce man as a whole in all his activities to the level of a conditioned and behaving animal, and that the bureaucratic harnesses that were going to be sort of put on people, the bureaucratic rules and regulations, have the effect of trying to normalize, as she put it, their behavior, to compel them to behave and to punish their spontaneous action or outstanding achievement. This is, I think, what the most dangerous thing about the social reform policies are, is that they can lead to this kind of stifling of individual initiative and creativity, this reduction of people to the social group. This is something that Trilling was very concerned about, and what disturbed him very much in the liberalism of his time, and Hannah Arendt as well.
Of the two great dystopian novels that we had, looking forward to a dire time, namely Orwell's 1984 and Huxley's Brave New World, who comes closer to voicing the apprehension that you've got right now?
Oh, I think Orwell.
Yeah?
I think Orwell very much. Trilling was very sympathetic to Orwell, and I think he said it well, that the greatest threat to human liberty and art in our time, he said in his review of Orwell's book, might well come from a massive development of the social idealism of our democratic culture. And he was looking at the liberals of his day and thought that their plans, if carried out, would lead to a kind of stifling of humanity that would be, that would make the sort of what he called arbitrary and great spirits would have no place in such a world.
I think it is not hidden from those who are listening to us tonight that both interviewer and interviewee are on the conservative side. And as you apply that to contemporary American politics, that leads to the question of who properly deserves or who would be the best person to put forward in presidential opposition to Mr. Obama at the end of next year. It is of interest to me and of great concern to me that in the way a strong, clear conservative approach to all the issues of polity that we have to face tends to scare lots of people who are in the Republican Party. That is, they're put off by those candidates who are clearly, strongly and outspokenly conservative. Why is that?
Yeah, I think there's an innate centrism in the population. I think the candidate who can seem, I think that's why President Obama was able to win, because his rhetoric was quite restrained, and he claimed to be, in his book *The Audacity of Hope*, a pragmatist.
His background, as you know, and has been documented by, among others.
Right, that was an unusual election in which the press, with a few exceptions, as you know, Stanley Kurtz.
Exactly, I was about to mention Stanley.
Ignored all of that, all the research that was painstakingly done, the really, I mean, in-depth work that he did in the different archives, piecing together the story of the president's commitment to the social progressive vision.
Do you think that the president's pre-presidential commitment to sort of, quote, democratic socialism, he literally belonged to an organization
right.
that calls itself democratic socialist. Do you think that that has affected significantly what he's done with the presidency?
I think so. I think it seems to, the health care legislation seems to be something that would almost be predicted or desired by some of the teachers and thinkers under whom he was either studying or who he worked with directly or indirectly through those different networks that Kurtz described in his book.
I wonder if he read your brief piece, The Dark Night of Islam, which is another one I said I wanted to talk about, but there's hardly time for it because we're shortly going to go to the phones for a few calls. But very briefly, what are you saying in this piece from the National Review about Islam?
Well, the question for Islam is can it reform in a way that will allow for the kinds of classical freedoms that we enjoy in the West?
You seem fairly pessimistic about that.
Yes, I just don't see any mainstream movement within Islam advocating such a course. I do know and have talked and met with some Islamic intellectuals who would like to show that their religion is compatible with freedom, tolerance, knowledge, and it's not an obscurantist faith. Their work, however, many of them have been educated in the West, in the United States or in France. Their work is good, but it's very academic. It's not something that's going to appeal to I think, the man in the street in Cairo or Baghdad. And until you find a leader who can can appeal, can reconcile. I mean, in the West, in the 17th century, there was a lot of religious persecution, intolerance, et cetera, in witch burning in New England. But you had the emergence of a movement that was able to sort of synthesize the modern vision of human freedom with the old Christian, Judeo-Christian heritage, and you worked out a pretty good synthesis, which was very important in the American Revolution, where a lot of the patriots, Jefferson included, used biblical imagery to advance the cause of building a free constitutional state.
You see no great promise, then, in the so-called Arab Spring.
I don't see that it's been prepared, that there's any group or leader that is offering a real change to what they had before. I mean, I think where you don't have that kind of group or leader or thinking in place, it's very unlikely that you're going to get a transition to a free democratic state. I don't see it. I think you need to reconcile the local customs, traditions, and faith with the democratic freedom for it to have any chance there. I think that was the very astute aspect of our policy in Japan after World War II, when MacArthur kept the emperor and kept the Shinto tradition, which he represented, and used it to become a bedrock for a free state, and that succeeded wonderfully. But it's not been possible to do that in the Islamic world that I've seen.
We are about to pause for our last quick round of commercials, and then on to the phones. If you want to call us, I say now to our listenership, now's the time to get your call in quickly at 312-591-7200. Any question you want to raise to Michael Knox Barron, now's the time to do it. 312-591-7200, or if you'd rather reach us via email, the email address extension 720 at WGNradio.com. Directly back after we pause for this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
If you want to join us to offer a thought and or for that matter to raise a question or contention, you may do so quickly. 312-591-7200 is the number. 312-591-7200 for email, extension 720 at WGNradio.com. Do you know the book, Michael, of some 50 years ago by Richard Weaver titled Ideas Have Consequences?
Yes.
I've always found that a very useful analysis of social thought and the way in which it has been translated into actual applied and activated policy. Which social thinkers have been? Do you agree with this thesis that ideas do have real consequences? That the philosophers or others sitting there scratching away late at night and then publishing may have far more influence than we ordinarily think they do?
Yes, although also especially it can be noted on thinkers who on politicians and statesmen who claim to be pure pragmatists. I think Keynes said they're often slaves to some dead thinker.
Yeah.
40 or 50 years before their time. I think the most baneful strain has been the strain of social philosophy that is traced by intellectual historians to Hegel, who was the huge influence on Marx and the various social philosophers of that time, Comte in France, who had John Stuart Mill had a very ambiguous relation with that. At times, Mill was the great champion of a kind of classical freedom. At other times, he was very attracted to the social philosophy that was emerging on the continent. And he said that all forms of social thought in his time were really a form of liberticide, of killing liberty, which I think is true. So he did sound that warning.
Most people listening to us, I should think, have just barely heard the name Hegel and don't have not read Hegel. They have heard of Marx, but very few have read Marx completely, including most Marxists, I'm sure. But what's the crucial principle in Hegelian social philosophy?
I think the main thing is treating focus on the group rather than the individual is one of the main problems. With Hegel, you have the movement of a civilization, which will embody the what he called the world spirit or Geist, and great leaders would sort of be animated by this world spirit and mold the world in consequence with it. So he follows, for example, Caesar transforming the Roman Republic as an act of historical necessity. And with this idea of historical necessity, there's the notion that there are laws in history and human behavior that can be deduced in the same way that, you know, we deduce the laws of nature or physics or biology, and that you can apply these to human conduct and create sort of what the French called a social physics.
Yeah. Well, the man who coined the notion of social physics was Auguste Comte, whom you
right.
mentioned. He was really a nutcase.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But he's considered the father of, among other things, sociology.
Yeah, but the influence of the social sciences, Hannah Arendt has some very interesting things to say about how baneful she thinks that's been in doing away with the focus on the individual and his achievement, which she looks upon as the great legacy of the classical heritage of the West, that the individual in Greece, the idea was that he should stand forth and realize his own excellence, that the social imagination, the social policies of work on a very different principle, that you should be reduced to the common denominator of the group by the application of these so-called laws, which sociologists and social theorists and social philosophers and social reformers can deduce.
Is it in the very nature of the social sciences for them to push towards reorganizing society and altruistically remaking life for ordinary people so as to solve their problems and, in fact, so as to supervise and regulate them?
I think there are plenty of people working in the social sciences who are interested in the disinterested pursuit of knowledge for its own sake. But I don't think you can deny that there are people that are attracted to the social sciences as a means of reconstructing the social order. You see it very prominently in the educators at the beginning of the 20th century
yes,
in the
indeed.
United States who shifted the curriculum toward social studies. And some of these, like Count and Ruggs, who were disciples of John Dewey, very openly said that they hope through social studies to reconstruct the American social order. For them, exposure to the social sciences beginning in primary school would turn children into what they call democratic citizens, and democracy is sort of the code word for citizens that want to put private capital under the control of the government and equalize wealth and property.
You see it today in some social science circles. For example, at Columbia in the School of Social Work, they hold people to having attitudes. They test them on their attitudes about social reconstruction and about increased socialization of everything. And if you don't pass what they require, they don't give you the degree.
Of some of the teachers' colleges in the country, that you're now the schools
yes.
themselves are graded, and candidates for teaching positions are graded on the extent to which they believe and are committed to social justice. Social
exactly.
justice being a term of art with a very specific meaning, the belief that our current system is oppressive and unjust and not really free, and it needs to be changed.
We're almost out of time. Do these things come in cycles? Are we going to kind of undo the present and return to some of the verities of an earlier time?
You know, I would agree with George Eliot that the most gratuitous form of error is prophecy. I think there is a lot of resilience in our ideas about freedom and opportunity, and that the left is counting on a new demographic shift that will change that and swamp the old, what I would call the people that sort of support the classical liberal.
That's the Hispanic hope, is it?
Yeah, but, you know, I think you look at historically, the country has absorbed all kinds of people from all different parts. And, you know, during their first generation, they here are struggling. Some of them might be attracted to the socialist idea. But most people come to this country because they want a better life for their children. And I think they very often change their minds and become...
Michael, I fear we're literally out of time.
Okay.
I thank you so much. It's been a very, very interesting conversation, and I'm very glad to have had the opportunity to talk with you again.
Thank you, Mel.
Michael Knox Barron, who is the author of a number of important books, can be read regularly at, among other things, the City Journal, which is one of the best journals published in the country as a quarterly. We come to the end of the available time until tomorrow at 10 for a full two-hour program. We'll be with you then. Thanks to all for listening, and a most cordial good night.